This podcast is supported by The RealReal. Meet Christine. She loves shopping. And this is the sound of fashion overload. Too many fabulous things, not enough space. So Christine started selling with The RealReal.
I've always loved collecting designer pieces. Gucci bags, Prada heels. But my style keeps evolving. Selling with The RealReal? Game changer. I earn more and they do everything.
Seriously, just drop off your items or schedule a pickup. We handle the photos, descriptions, pricing, even shipping. You just sit back and watch your items sell fast to our 40 million members.
And I get peace of mind knowing I earn more selling with The RealReal than anywhere else.
Exactly. That's the sound of your closet working for you. The RealReal. Earn more, save time, sell fast. And only for the month of January, earn up to $550 extra when you sell with The RealReal. That's right, up to $550 extra. Go to TheRealReal.com to get started. Earn up to $550 extra this month at TheRealReal.com. Terms apply.
Welcome to Season 4 of the Chai Break Podcast. This is your invitation to grab a cup of piping hot chai and get ready for chaivizations that nourish the soul and inspire your everyday. This season, we're diving deep into the world of sustainable living. More than ever, we need to find ways to live in harmony with our planet. So throughout the season, I'll be talking to climate tech entrepreneurs, exploring practical tips from experts, and uncovering the joy of living a life that's good for you and good for Mother Earth. Hello, hello, and welcome back to the Chai Break Podcast. After a mini hiatus, life has been a whirlwind of sorts, and me being me, I never settle for anything less than an episode, a topic, a guest that truly speaks to me. Staying true to the pillars of this podcast, which was authenticity, purpose, impact, and vulnerability. My guest today is someone who embodies each of these qualities and someone who I've quietly admired and followed until recently when our paths crossed at the New York Sari event, which was hosted at the New York Historical Society. More on that in our episode today. But without further ado, my guest today is Nikita Shah, a multidisciplinary artist, textile designer, educator, and researcher, whose work bridges the 3,000-year-old ancient craft of kalamkari with community, contemporary expression, education, and healing. She is the founder of Untitled by Nikita, an ode to slow fashion, and she also runs a monthly workshop called Fursat at her studio space in Brooklyn, weaving a similar thread of creating spaces for rest, reflection, and community storytelling through textile craft. Welcome to the Chai Break Podcast, Nikita. I'm so excited to share this chaivization with you.
Yay. Thank you for having me.
So before we get into, you know, the world of kalamkari and your work, talk us about, you know, your roots and your early influences and what first drew you to textiles, craftsmanship, and sustainability at large.
I think like earliest roots are just seeing growing up around my mother and you know, she always wore cottons and cared for her cottons, right? Like you have to wash them separately, starch them, mm-hmm. iron mm-hmm. them. And I saw her giving her that kind of care. And that's like my earliest memories of, you know, textiles. And I just grew up, you know, hearing these words, right? Venkatgiri and indigo and dabu and, you know, these things that I had no clue about. But I saw it. And I think from there, like, I just like happened to like get into design school. I wanted to do fashion, but I ended up in textiles. And, you know, like at that time, like I didn't know what it meant, but it was life changing. And, you know, now that I'm 20 years into this industry, like, you know, like I can reflect back and be like, okay, it makes complete sense. Mm-hmm. But even sustainability, right? Like growing up middle class in India, right? Like it meant that I always got like clothes from my cousins mm-hmm. and that would mm-hmm. be like upcycled mm-hmm. or, you know, like I wouldn't like the neck and I would like go to my tailor and, you know, like be like, can you change this? Can we add this? Or, you know, like take something else from my nani or my dadi and, you know, so mm-hmm. it really was just a way of life.
Way of life. That's exactly right. Yeah.
Like I say this, that we didn't grow up with these like buzzwords, right? That sustainability and like upcycling and all of that embodied in our daily life.
Yeah. No, that's exactly what I say. I feel like long before this was a buzzword, it was just a way of life and it was just simple, you know?
Yeah.
And I think I always wonder where that transition came when suddenly like secondhand and hand-me-down and all of that kind of became taboo. And even like, you know, for our, you know, diaspora and the Indian subcontinent at large to kind of break back into that thrifting and secondhand concept was looked down upon. And I think we're slowly turning a corner. But, you know, I feel like we suddenly had this surge of consumerism and Western influence that made everything like, you know, the lifespan became shorter and everything became seasonal and, you know, micro trends and trends and all of that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So you spent, you know, I think in your story, one of the focal points for me was the years you spent working with indigenous weavers, the craft clusters across India. What was it like actually living in those communities? And how did those early experiences shape your artistic vision? I'd love to hear your time in Maheshwar. Is that right? That's where you spent your time. Yeah.
So Maheshwar was life-changing. I was probably 20 and I got rejected from one of the big companies in Bombay to do my graduation project. And like a week before, I had nowhere to go and I had to do my project. So through one of my professors, I ended up in Maheshwar and I spent about 5 months living in Maheshwar. And, you know, as an urban young, you know, teen adult, you know, who grew up very urban in Bombay, like it was a complete like 360 degree like flip for me, right? Like really the mornings would be slow. You know, everyone is working, everyone has their way of working, but everyone also has their way of also just resting and having fun, right? Like whenever I would go, I always had to have tea and you know, like then eat, drink tea, and there would be some nashta or you know, something. Then work would start, you know, some days when, you know, when the mood is not right, we would just go to the river and sit by the Narmada or just look at the sunset. And like all of those things also became like part of work and the part of how you create.
Exactly.
But I think the biggest like, you know, turning point for me was this was maybe 2 months before my graduation project had to end and none of the saris were actually on the loom. And like, you know, I was getting stressed and they were like, yeah, we'll start 10 days after 10 days, and I was like, "Why?" They're like, "No, Holi hai, fir Ganga, there's going to be Gangor, and you know, there like, no one is going to work for the next 10 days." They're like, "You can go to Bombay if you want and come back after 10 days." And I was like, "This, I was stressed, like sweating. I'm like, I am going to like fail, and I'm not going to have my project ready." And he was like, "You don't stress; it will happen, and you know, like whatever." And I didn't end up going to Bombay. I stayed there for those 10 days. And on the 11th day, like, not just the two weavers who were supposed to weave for me. They're like wives, they're neighbors, other weavers. Like, everyone came. And like, the process that a person would do in probably like 3 days, like, 7 people came and like in half a day, both my looms were like set up and ready and like ready to go. And that is when, you know, like, when I look back at my time, like that moment becomes so important where when they're not working, they're not working. Yeah. But, you know, when someone needs something,
they come entire together.
Comes together, right? And I saw this like over like some deaths, some funerals that, you know, in my time period when I was there and over the next decade, right? Like it becomes family in ways that, you know, like, it's an extended family where you can create together and everyone has an expertise and, you know, everyone gets it, right? So I think like that kind of like ecosystem and way of creating is something that I've tried to carry in my practice.
No, that I feel like it's almost like you said, all of that rest and reflection and celebration and, you know, all of that kind of becomes part of the creativity, right? Part of that process.
Yeah.
And that is beautiful because I feel like in our time now, we've not made time for that.
like, actually, like, it's almost this thing of like, we're so crazy with speed and productivity that even as a person, as an individual, if you're just sitting down and doing nothing, you're like, oh my God, how can I fill that time? What can I do to be efficient and productive, right? And yeah, no, that's a great, you know, experience that you had, that kind of you've carried through. And yeah, it's so important, especially today.
Yeah. And even back then, right, like being in design school, you know, you were taught like mood boards and timelines and, you know, adhering to all of that. And that's the mindset with, you know, that is the mindset that I knew. And I, all of that was like, it came crumbling down, right, in this little town. And for that, I'm very grateful,
And at what point and what led you to the world, the amazing, beautiful world of Kalamkari? How did you discover it? And what part of it spoke to you so deeply that you, you know, you've carried it across the oceans?
Yeah. I think what speaks to me deeply about Kalamkari is just the dyes, the natural dyes. Those were, again, colors that I saw my mother wearing a lot, right? Like, she was very natural. So, like, I grew up around indigo and, like, you know, resist print and batik and all of that. But I think specifically Kalamkari, like, so I came across Kalamkari through working for a designer in India. And, you know, for the designer, I worked with over like 13 different crafts, and Kalamkari was one of them. And while Kalamkari was one of them, like, you know, I was also working with Ajrak, you know, which is block printing in Gujarat, or Bagru, block printing in Rajasthan, you know, apart from weaves and all of that, right? Like, these were the two, three like clusters that were working with natural dyes in different ways. What was exciting about Kalamkari is that it was like art, right? And again, because it's all freehand drawn, as opposed to block printing, which has the limitation of a block repeated, right? So that was very exciting, and the colors were very exciting. And I first like saw Kalamkari at this designer's fashion show in Lakme, where he'd done Kalamkaris with Kanjivarams, right? So for me, what was exciting was that these were textiles and clothes that I had seen in my mother's and grandmother's closets, but this is not.
This podcast is supported by The Real Real. Meet Christine. She loves shopping. And this is the sound of fashion overload. Too many fabulous things, not enough space. So Christine started selling with The Real Real.
I've always loved collecting designer pieces, Gucci bags, Prada heels, but my style keeps evolving. Selling with The Real Real, game changer. I earn more and they do everything.
Seriously, just drop off your items or schedule a pickup. We handle the photos, descriptions, pricing, even shipping. You just sit back and watch your items sell fast to our 40 million members.
And I get peace of mind knowing I earn more selling with The Real Real than anywhere else.
Exactly. This? That's the sound of your closet working for you. The Real Real. Earn more, save time, sell fast. And only for the month of January, earn up to $550 extra when you sell with The Real Real. That's right, up to $550 extra. Go to TheRealReal.com to get started. Earn up to $550 extra this month at TheRealReal.com. Terms apply.
What I had seen in fashion and on the runways, and to be able to see that was like, something like just exploded in my mind. And I think that was like the first collection that, you know, the first like textile collection that I saw on the runway. So I think there is a kind of like resonance around that also.
Yeah, because I feel like when you think of, you know, as you talk about mainstream fashion, I was just like visualizing, what did mainstream fashion look at that time? It was mainly like a lot of like just sequin embroidery and zari. And, you know, there was nothing beyond that.
Yeah.
Right. Like the tactile nature of, you know, textile weaves and, you know, this kind of art, you know, like Kalamkari is practically like an art form, you know, that was not there. And I think I can imagine as a young, you know, designer who's kind of like building a career, like what that would have meant for you.
Yeah. And like, again, like this was 2012 when, you know, like handlooms were not cool in the fashion and. Like, again, like you said, it was mostly like net and sequins and gum, and, you know, like, so it was really exciting to work in that time period, you know, where it wasn't cool and you were like still working with it. And now there are like so many, there's National Handloom Day, and there is like, you know, sari day and this day and that. Like back then there was nothing. Yeah.
So now let's come to the world of Untitled by Nikita. How did that happen? And I've always been very intrigued since I found you online about the name Untitled.
Yeah. I think the name comes from the fact that I don't necessarily want to be boxed. Right? And also, again, like thinking about fashion, you know, how growing up in India, I only and mostly wear cottons because it's the most like comfortable on my skin and body. Mm-hmm. And when I would do that to like weddings or like, you know, like events, you know, my family members would be like, you can't wear cotton to a wedding. You can't wear, you know, like there are these kind of demarcations and you like, this is only okay for home and this is only okay for like outside and whatever. So I think Untitled also like comes from like breaking all of that. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, like, putting yourself first and like, or at least like thinking about yourself first and what feels right on your body and to your body. But also what I like about the name is whenever I've gone to museums and I am always drawn towards untitled paintings because I think there is a kind of special relationship that you form with the art based on your own relation, you know, your own life experiences, relationships or whatever, as opposed to like having a title and, you know, they direct you in a certain
way. Yes, to think and, you know, see it a certain way.
Yeah. So I think these were the two kind of like big factors that led to like having my brand as Untitled. Also at that point, and even at this point, you know, like people say that, oh, are you a designer or a visual artist? Or wait, are you a historian? But you also do anthropology, you know, like whatever. And I'm like, you know, why does it have to be one thing, right? Like, why does it have to have one title? So I was like, really, at that point, I was also very frustrated with people, you know, wanting to like box me in one certain thing.
Because they want to understand it within the realms of, you know, what, you know, standard society has defined it, right?
Yeah. And I say that, you know, that realm is Indian, you know, like handcrafted or in textiles, you know, like I do multiple things within it. And, you know, now like even more narrowing down to Kalamkari, I'm like, that is the realm, right? But I'm like, I want to like dive deep into that realm of it, which means that doing these different things and that all inform each other, right?
And you primarily with Untitled by, you know, the brand, you worked with a lot of deadstock fabric, right? And where did the pieces get made? And, you know, what was, how did you integrate all of this preservation, memory and craftsmanship into each of the garments that you created?
Yeah. So the fabric came from a few different parts. All the Kalamkaris came from Kalam Creations by Mamta Reddy. So she had a lot of like, not necessarily damaged, but, you know, like not standard quality as per, you know, industrial levels. Similarly, during the pandemic, I got a ton of fabrics from Ajrakpur, similar way they had like these kind of like dead stock and no one is buying and, you know, rejects and things like that. So I collected fabric from them. And I collected fabric from Fab Scrap over here in New York for the wools, for the linens, for the more like non-Indian textile kind of fabric. And yeah, like, you know, like it was these kind of different segments and in these two different parts that I was exposed to and had access to, right? And like, you know, I collected bits and pieces of them. All of the, like, I used to work with this in the garment district over here in New York. And, you know, like that's where I went and I created samples and I created the collection in the garment district. I worked with them. So it was this kind of like also trying to like integrate these two worlds, right?
Yes.
But also like thinking about like supply chain and production, right? What does it mean for like me to sit here, but like design without seeing the textile? Like, could I, you know, just get the pictures from India, design and get it produced in India? I could, but you know, does it like give me or inform me as much as I need, right? And, you know, like wool and those kind of fabrics are more, I want to say they're more like weather appropriate over here, right? Get over here. So that again became a point of choice. And, you know, like figuring these kind of like supply chain systems and, you know, production systems where, you know, everyone is also like paid fairly, but also like what makes sense to the process, right? Working between the world.
So, and did you know where you source the fabric from and the type of fabric and your, you know, creative process of kind of melding these two worlds? Did that inform your design process and, you know, the kind of prints and patterns and designs that you wanted to, you know?
So like the design process almost completely reverses when you work with upcycling, right? You're not sketching first and, you know, you don't have a mood board first and then you go and buy fabric, right? It really is that the fabric informs your design. You know, I got these, like a lot of these pallus, right? They were just pallus. And like, I'm like, okay, it's a rectangle. What can I do out of it, right? Like kind of shape. And like the motors were like these big peacocks, you know, they weren't smaller prints or smaller motors, right? So that's when the cape came into being, right? Because you that shape. Or I had like these small chindis, you know, small scraps. And I was like, what can I do out of this that's not a scrunchie, right?
That's like always.
No offense. You know, like I love a scrunchie, but I'm, you know, thinking about like, what can I do out of this? And that's when, like, you know, I started making those corsets, you know, with the little over there. So it was really that the pieces itself, the textile itself informs the design, right? What is the weight of the textile? You know, if it's like super thin cotton, you know, mull cotton, or if it's a little silk, you know, silk becomes a dress, you know, or the cotton is maybe then lined and quilted if I want something thicker, or, you know, it's like completely soft. So it's really like, and I tell this to, you know, design students who want to like, you know, upcycle. I'm like, it really is about the fact that your design process completely changes. And the way you think about clothes also completely change.
That's wonderful. Now let's talk Fursuit. You know, when I think of Fursuit and when I heard the word Fursuit, I feel like it's a true embodiment of slow fashion. You know, the one that makes me think of our good old days when we would go and buy fabric, you know, in the gully gullies of, you know, wherever, whichever city you lived in. Then we had our local neighborhood, you know, tailor bhaiya, we would go discuss design. And I still remember they had like these books that they would flip through, you know, this is for the neckline and this is for the slit. And, you know, oh, this fabric, we can do this, we can do that. So it was a little bit of like, you know, his input, what maybe you've seen in some movie or like some, you know, new popular pop culture video that came out, you know, and then came that sweet wait period where, you know, by the time you give it and the that waiting period to go pick it up, you know, and the beauty of that almost was there was no instant gratification. There was no dopamine hit of like, your order is shipped today, that we all, you know, like are trapped in at this point in our, you know, in this world today. So tell us about Fursuit. How did that idea come to you?
So Fursuit is like many, it's just the practice and the approach, right? Like that translates into many different, again, like channels, right? But speaking about fashion itself and the brand itself, it's exactly what you said. It's just an elevated version of it, right? I think it's also the fact that I don't think that we need new clothes in this world, right? And this is something that a lot of like my family is not going to be happy that I say this, right? Like from a brand perspective, they're like, you should not, you have to sell, right? Like in that sense, but it's like, really thinking about like what we need and, you know, when something is expensive, you already start thinking about, am I really going to wear this, right? Like how much use am I going to get out of this, right? How many different ways can I wear this, right? And like all of my pieces are like designed thinking about that. And I'm like, they are expensive because everyone is paid fairly, right? And this is the actual cost of it. Like if everyone was paid fairly, The only thing is that we wouldn't be buying, like, you know, 80 outfits a year. And, you know, we would be...
This podcast is supported by The RealReal. Meet Christine. She loves shopping. And this is the sound of fashion overload. Too many fabulous things, not enough space. So Christine started selling with The RealReal.
I've always loved collecting designer pieces. Gucci bags, Prada heels. But my style keeps evolving. Selling with The RealReal? Game changer. I earn more and they do everything.
Seriously, just drop off your items or schedule a pickup. We handle the photos, descriptions, pricing, even shipping. You just sit back and watch your items sell fast to our 40 million members.
And I get peace of mind knowing I earn more selling with The RealReal than anywhere else.
Exactly. This? That's the sound of your closet working for you. The RealReal. Earn more, save time, sell fast. And only for the month of January, earn up to $550 extra when you sell with The RealReal. That's right, up to $550 extra. Go to TheRealReal.com to get started. Earn up to $550 extra this month at TheRealReal.com. Terms apply.
Buying maybe five, and that's exactly how much we need, right? So I think it came from there. And again, like, there is no instant gratification with my brand. A lot of people who come to me are actually working class, upper middle class, you know, people with full-time jobs who come to me. And for them, it is expensive. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, I'm like, you know, let's, when I think about this, I think about two things. I'm like, you know, how our grandmothers would save money in their rice dabba and chawal dabba and atta dabba to buy those nice saris, you know, on Diwali, or, you know, buy those like five nice things. So I'm like, okay, let's break it down into payment parts. Mm. I'm like, you know, 6 months, 1 year, mm. 8 months, four mm. months, you know, whatever works with you, mm. which also gives me the time to really like sit and work on the piece.
Yeah.
It gives me this kind of space. Again, like there is no, your order has been shipped.
Exactly.
You know, one fine day it'll be ready and they'll get it. They're like, oh my God, I wasn't thinking that I was going to get this week and I got it. And it's thing, right?
Yeah.
But it really is, you know, that process of making the consumer or, you know, think about what they really need and what they use, right? And what they like cherish and wear, right? And also, you know, we often spend a lot of money on, you know, like special occasion and wedding clothing and, you know, things like that, things that you would probably wear twice in your lifetime. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, why wouldn't you do that to something that you would actually wear a lot more often, right?
Yes.
So that's where, you know, the slowing down of Untitled comes is really, you know, actually making the consumer slow down.
Yes. Uh-huh. And you're kind of honoring, you know, the time and the creative process of the person creating it. Yeah. And, you know, you also, like, you're enabling someone to be able to afford these pieces by offering them, you know, these, a little financial freedom as well.
Yeah.
And I feel like when you have pieces like that, you really cherish them. You know, I remember I actually got something, I bought something from India from this sustainable brand. From the order, they actually took my measurements. It took a month and a half to make it. And then they shipped it to me. And I'm telling you, it is the most prized possession I have.
Yeah.
And I think what deeply, deeply resonates with me is the way you think about fashion. Because that is me. I'm like, is it a need or is it a want? One. Is it versatile? How many different ways am I going to wear this? Is this like a temporary thing or color of the season or a trend that I'm like looking for? Yeah. You know, and at most, like sometimes, you know, because we're all human and we live in this fast world today. Yeah. So I'm like, okay, I'll just add it to my cart. It just gives me happiness. I just leave it there. It's not that I'm going to buy it. Like 6 months later, if I'm still thinking about it, or like a couple months later, maybe then, you know, and I think like, I have found the most unique pieces secondhand. Thrifting is like a big, big thing. And exactly the way you explained that, how you explained to your family, I've had to do it at home. And, you know, I'm like, no, but just think about it. Do you think if you've paid like $50 for something, like the person who's like made it, those hands, are they being paid? Like, you know, it is an ecosystem. We all live in a society where we have to look out for each other. So I think that mindset shift is hard and it's not a pleasant conversation to have because no one wants to hear it. But I think it, you know, it needs to happen.
Absolutely.
Thank you. So what does a typical Fursat workshop look like for someone who's interested and wants to join?
Yeah, so Fursat really, like, you know, even the brand and the workshops really come from these, again, like traditions and, you know, traditions of the margins of textiles, you know, as I sometimes say, or traditions of rest in textiles, right? Like they really come from there. They come from Maheshwar, right? When they took that break, or, you know, when you have chai, or, you know, they come from a time in Ajrakpur, or, you know, like after lunch, you'll have a break for an hour where people are just like either napping or eating a fruit, or, you know, things like that. Yeah. So I think at a typical workshop, it's generally in like 3 to 4 parts through the like semester based. I kind of encourage people coming to all of them. Again, like I said, this is not a networking event, you know, it's really a space where you can connect and be with other people, even if you don't meet them outside of that space ever in your life again, right? But in that space itself. And you learn textiles, kalamkari, and some forms of embroideries, different forms of embroideries. And like that, typically they start around in the evening. They go up, like, you know, officially I say like 2.5 hours, but, you know, 6 to 9, I'll say. And, you know, people are here till like 11:30 or 12 for many, many. And that's the whole point of it, right? Like, you know, in this day and age where, you know, we have so much on our calendar, I say that, like, come with your calendar open for the evening and see where it takes you, right? Like, it's again, like, you know, thinking and honoring your own body and, like, you know, being closer to it, that, you know, okay, I'm done. I'm, you know, I'm tired, you know, I can't sit anymore after an hour and they leave, or, you know, someone is here for 6 hours or, you know, whatever. In that sense, it really is that kind of time and space that I try to create. And we like, there'll be some kind of like drinks or like, you know, like chai or tea, fruits, some kind of like snacks, whatever. So like you're eating and creating and you're just like making and learning a new craft. And again, this thing of perfection, right? Like my piece has to be this like beautiful piece and it has to be perfect. And I'm like, yeah, if you keep doing it for maybe like 8 or 10 years or like even 2 years, like, but for now, that's not the point, right? Like, it's not the space. It's when you learn something new, you will fumble and you will fall, right? So that's the whole point.
But it's still your hands and, you know, your time, your thought process, your creativity. So I feel like, I think that's where we need to get back, you know, dial it back and actually pause. And that's when you appreciate the little nuances of that process.
Yeah.
So speaking of sustainability and, you know, today's, you know, culture of like where we have access to information, resources and everything, something you and I discussed, and I think this year I actually even read an article about it. Diwali, obviously, in the diaspora, you know, space here has kind of like blown up. In the best way possible. Now everybody knows about it and all of that. And, you know, definitely not to be judgmental by any means. Do you feel that there is, from a missed opportunity standpoint, because there are so many people, again, with access to everything, right, at their fingertips. And why is it that it's only the over-the-top lehenga culture, you know, during this time? And where do you think, you know, people can actually tap into our countries and our subcontinent's rich roots in craftsmanship and how that can show up?
I think, you know, it's the fact that most people in the diaspora are only wearing their Indian South Asian clothes at these like special occasions. Right? Which means that they go like fully out because it's the one time, or, you know, the 2 days of the year that they get to dress up. I think for people like us, right? Like who wear saris more regular, more every day, or wear our textiles in different ways more regular, we have a different relationship to clothes, right? To our South Asian clothes. And I think it's that bridge that is kind of like missing, where you know, if they were able to incorporate their South Asian textiles and clothes in like everyday life in whatever way, I think this lehenga, over the top lehenga culture, but you know, their relationship to that would change.
Yeah.
You know, in ways where, like, even weddings, and I don't say this in the diaspora, like even back in India and back home, like the wedding lehenga culture has changed drastically in the last like 10 years, right? Like our mothers were not married, you know, in such clothes, right? They were wed in like in like faces that look like themselves even today. So I think it's again like that kind of fashion system that promotes this kind of over the topness, and that's what then becomes aspiration, right?
So I think it's those small changes where you can build a relationship, a sustainable, you know, relationship with our culture and our clothing, and how you can incorporate a piece into your existing wardrobe versus, you know, making it like this standout occasion piece that, like you said, you wear only those two times of the year. And like I mentioned at the top of our podcast, so our paths crossed at the New York Sari exhibit. And it was almost surreal for me. Like, I remember as an, you know, as an Indian girl and as an immigrant, you know, as a South Asian living in the city for like 14 years now, to just walk into this iconic location like the New York Historical Society and see the garment that is quintessentially part of our, you know, like our culture, our, like our subcontinent, and see the sari on display. Talk to us about this opportunity and what your role and the vision you had, and you know how it all came about.
So I got introduced to the curators through a friend, Ruafza, whose sari is in the show. And I made a film with a friend called Sari Not Sorry. So they, you know, the curator reached out to me to kind of like have the video as a part of their exhibit. But as we spoke, they were like, oh, would you come and drape the saris on the mannequin? And I'm like, absolutely, yes. And then like, would you do a little like video about how to wear a sari? Because again, like, I wear the sari every day, you know, for the most part. And, you know, as much as it is identity, it's also the fact that it is the most sustainable garment, right? I don't have memories of, you know, being five and taking my mom's sari and draping it around me and, you know, like things like that. I don't. I think I started wearing the sari when I was working with textiles. And, you know, like there was a point when I realized I'm like, I have 20 saris and, you know, like they're just sitting in my closet and what do I do, right? And that's when I started wearing my saris to work every day. And I built a relationship to the sari, right? And it just became this like garment that was also formal, also casual, you know. Also, I could dress up my sari. I could dress the same sari down in a different way, right? Like so many different things that I could do with the sari and have a relationship with my body while doing it, right? Because when you wear a sari, like, you know, you are thinking about, you're seeing your body in ways that you don't see when you're actually putting a stitched garment on, right?
And, you know, I feel like the sari is also like the most non-judgmental piece of garment. Like any body can still, you know, drape it on and it becomes a part of you. Part of your fabric.
And I think that was my pull into just wearing saris, right? And I continued doing that even in New York. And people are like, oh, you're a sari expert. And I'm like, yes, maybe. But I'm like, you know, it's just something that I wore and I did every day, right? Like, we weren't taught the sari in design school or, you know, no one taught me how to like drape a sari, right? Like,
You just saw your mother, grandmother, aunts.
And grandmothers to do it and like, you know, help them pull their pleats down or, you know, level the pleats down. That's, you know, that was, so it's so embodied, right? And then you see this kind of like embodied garment in this, again, like you said, like this exhibit that is like so excellently curated, right? And it tells the story about these different kinds of people who've migrated to New York and worn their bodies in different ways, right?
Especially that black and white, the portraits of like people, you know, just in New York City. That was just so beautiful.
Chitra Ganesh's work. Exactly. So like, again, like to, you know, think about this kind of government and how it shifts when you migrate, right? And mm-hmm. when you're in a, like, if you've not grown up over here and you've come from India mm-hmm. or, you know, South Asia, and you come over here and now the sari becomes resistance, or, you yes. know, the sari becomes so many different things. And, you know, some, and they're like, oh, you are an activist. And I'm like, no, I, you know, I just like wearing the sari,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
So it's for me, it's always like interesting how people here, like, you know, look at things yeah. that are just so like,
it's almost like an icebreaker, right?
Yeah.
Like, I think that's like the, you know, that's the first thing that they want to, like, you know, talk about or ask you about.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I actually remember about it. It was 2 years ago when I was in Soho, and I was, I don't know for what, but I was in a cotton sari, and I was just crossing the street with my sneakers and cotton sari, and this girl was like, hey, that is so cool. And I was like, oh, what is cool? Like, because you don't think about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I totally agree, because I was someone who never imagined myself that, you know, I would be comfortable wearing a sari. I always thought of it as like, oh my God, I don't know how to walk in it. Like, I will step over my pleats. Like, you know, that was my 20s.
Yeah.
Literally stumbling and, you know, having this weird relationship with it. And now, like, pretty much like half of my mother's closet is, you know, in my house. You
yeah.
know, I'm always like, you know, send me more saris, send me more saris, you know. And I also feel like every sari has a story. And I think that is the beautiful part of the garment, you know. When did I buy it? Where did I buy it? Where did I wear it? And, you know, now it's like become like part of my vocabulary in the way I dress.
But it's also like building that relationship with the sari and yes. your body, right?
Uh-huh,
and like,
uh-huh.
also, I think it's about like breaking the norm of what a perfect sari looks like or should
Absolutely.
Look like,
Absolutely.
Right? Mm-hmm. Like, I remember, like, in India, you know, whenever I wore these saris to work, like, I had, like, few co-workers who were these, like, older aunties. And they were like, oh, your pleats should be in the center, you know, but my pleat would be a little on my left hip, you know. Oh, your sari's too short, you know, and it has to, like, you know, it has to, like, touch the
yes.
ground. And I'm like, if it touches the ground, you know, I can't, like, move and work and do whatever. Right? Like, so I'm like, and, you know, the pleats, like, you know, they just feel better on the little bit on the left hip, you know, than in the center of my body. It, you know, helps me walk faster and, you know, do what I need to do. So it's also like these kind of connotations
yes.
That, you know, come with the sari, that it has to look a certain way. And, you know, where we kind of forget the varied kind of drapes that exist,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Like the seasonal drapes and
uh-huh.
not just the like perfectly pleated
exactly.
navy sari that you wear. It's you know, like through, again, like through this kind of like informal, you know, when I would travel and live with the weavers, you know, different states, different places, right? Like, I would see women around wearing like different kinds of saris and different lengths, right? Like even the kashta, sometimes it's
yes.
up to the knee, right?
Yes.
Because when they're
uh-huh.
working in the fields or
uh-huh.
agriculture or fisherwomen in Bombay,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
all of that.
Yeah.
And it's actually adaptable to you. And your life and,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
your whatever you are doing in that piece of garment. And you don't have to adapt yourself to, you know, that piece of clothing.
That's right. Yeah.
And yet we are like, you know, again, like it's this thing of like, it has to look this way.
Uh-huh.
I'm like, only thing it has to do is like, it has to feel good on your body.
Exactly. No, and that's why the way I try to drape, whenever I drape a sari, like I call it the New York sari, because it adapts to my lifestyle here. You know, I can wear it with boots. I can layer it. I don't need a blouse for it. I don't need a petticoat for it, you know. So I just tie a knot and then you just go about your way.
Yeah.
You just wear a crop top. You wear a blouse. You wear, you know,
a
boho
sweater.
Blouse,
yeah.
a sweater. It's,
yeah.
you know, it's adaptable to everything and your, you know, life situation, where you are and how you work. And I think that's the beauty of it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But again, like it is about like breaking those like norms in our
exactly.
head, right?
Exactly.
To be this. Sorry,
yes.
on the post.
Yeah. So before we wrap up, you know, we're on the Chai Break podcast. So let's play a little rapid fire round to see what, you know, it'll be fun.
Okay.
So How do you like your chai?
Oh, I like my chai with a lot of ginger and a little bit of lemongrass, actually.
Ooh, I haven't tried that. Maybe I should.
Come over.
Yes. And do you have like a favorite snack pairing or something nostalgic that you'd like to have with it?
Unfortunately, Parle-ji. I know Parle-ji.
My parents are visiting, so I have like a stash of Parle-ji sitting there.
Yes.
And, you know, dunk it just the right amount. Otherwise, it's going to like, you know, go and just like fall right in.
Yes.
Yes. What is your favorite season in New York?
Ooh. You know, lately it's become fall.
Mm-hmm.
And especially like, you know, summer in New York is always so exciting and fun and, you know, so much happening that when fall actually comes, I'm like, I can breathe and I can slow down.
I know, right?
Yeah. So I think fall, yeah.
What are you currently reading?
What am I currently reading? I'm reading Lessons in Drag, a book by a friend, Kareem.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm also reading The Body Keeps Score.
Ooh, I like that one.
Yeah.
I like that one. And how do you practice sustainability in your daily life? What are some things that just, you know, come so naturally to you and others that you've, you know, adapted over time?
So many different things, right? But I think one thing that I didn't do back in India and I do over here is like, I try to like grow my microgreens a little bit in my little pot. So I think that's one way that I try to like stay connected to the land. You know, in New York, so I think like that's one big thing that I like doing. And just like being more mindful, right? Like, in everything that you do. Yeah.
Nikita, thank you so much for sharing your journey, your craft, and, you know, your thoughts on everything sustainability. It's rare to meet someone like you who weaves together heritage, healing, community so beautifully. And I can't wait for our listeners to hear your story.
Thank you for having me. This was just so wonderful to, again, like similarly talk to someone who understands, comes from similar like roots and then like has built a life over here and this beautiful community. It's just wonderful and very exciting.
Yeah. So where can our, you know, listeners find you and, you know, follow you? So just
On Instagram, I'm nikita.untitle, untitle. In the present tense. And yeah, my website is also called untitle.com. So you can also see my work over there.
Absolutely. And for everyone listening, I'm going to leave all the show notes with the links to Nikita's handles. And please do follow her. And I hope you enjoyed this conversation. So until next time, bye everyone.
Bye.
Thank you for joining us for season 4 of the Chai Break podcast. We hope you leave here feeling inspired. To stay connected, follow us on Instagram at chai_break_podcast. Want even more sustainable goodness? Sign up for our monthly newsletter at chaibreakpodcast.substack.com. Packed with exclusive content, new episode drops, and more. And don't forget to like, share, and leave a review wherever you listen to podcasts. Your support means the world to us.